From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. We're bringing you conversations with directors whose films are showing this week at the True False Film Fest. The films range from intimate family portraits to large union strikes to policing in the modern era. These conversations will bring you an in-depth look at how the films came to be and what you can expect when the fest starts in a few days. In Bisbee 17, director Robert Greene looks at Bisbee, Arizona, a town on the border between the U.S. and Mexico. It was home to an influential copper mining camp in the early 1900s. And a century ago, 1,200 union workers, mostly immigrants, were deported across state lines. Greene, who also works at the Missouri School of Journalism, spoke with KBIA's Abby Ivory Gagne about how film examines the past and its influence on the present.
The first thing I want to talk about is the quote that opens the movie.
The quote is from a book called Ghostland by Colin Dickey. Cities that are haunted seem to straddle the past and present as though two versions of the same city are overlaid on top of each other. It's a quote from a book my wife read, and the reason why I went to Bisbee in the first place was because my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, bought a house there in 2003, and we went there to sort of work on the house. And I fell in love with the town. I'm not really a person who believes in ghosts necessarily, but I can tell you, I can promise you that New Orleans is a haunted town and Bisbee's a haunted town. It just has that feeling.
Can you tell me a little bit about what happened in Bisbee?
So Bisbee is a town that was the queen of the copper camps. It was one of the most important copper mining centers in America and even the world. And over the course of maybe 100 years or so, the mines were open and immigrants from all over the world would pour in from other mining places around the world to work in the mines of Bisbee. And it was like this thriving place, basically. And now the mines closed in 1975. But 100 years ago, in 1917, 1,200 striking miners, most of them immigrants, they've been radicalized by the industrial workers of the world, which was the most radical union in the history of this country, and maybe one of the most radical unions in the history of the world, came to town and basically said, you got to fight for higher wages and better working conditions. And this was a place that was known as a white man's camp. So they also wanted to fight for racial equality. And like Mexican workers couldn't work below ground, which means they couldn't make as much money, things like that. And this was 2 months into the First World War. And basically, Bisbee was super important to the war effort. So The strike was immediately much more controversial than even a regular strike is. The mining company conspired with the local sheriff and local shop owners and pro-war citizens to round up the striking miners by gunpoint. 2,000 were rounded up. 1,200 of them were shipped out of town on cattle cars and dropped in the middle of the desert of New Mexico and just left there. And that became known as the Bisbee deportation. And what the film does is tell that story, but tell it through recreating it by collaborating with locals to inhabit the characters on either side of the debate and then recreate the deportation itself on the 100th anniversary of when it happened, which the town was already commemorating in other ways.
And there were people in the movie who had lived in the town for, some of them said they were born and raised there or had lived there for a number of years, and they said they'd never heard about the Bisbee deportation until you started asking about it.
I mean, the deportation has long been sort of whitewashed from the town's history. The truth is there's definitely some people in town who commemorate it every single year, but there's plenty of people who still don't know anything about it. And even if you do know something about the deportation in Bisbee, up until very, very recently, the general vibe has been, we don't talk about that here. And that's largely because the people who did the deporting were the descendants of the mining company.
So I want to talk about the reenactments, because one of the people who participated in the reenactment, at the end of it, he said, it's kind of like the biggest group therapy session ever. So talk a little bit about that.
We consider them sort of like interventions with reality or something, because we've collaborated with the folks in town to create these sort of staged interventions. The idea was really that we would find people in town who had a connection to the story, or people who didn't have a connection to the story, but had a connection with the place, and use these interventions, use these reenactments to, I don't know, rattle the ghost's cage a little bit and see what comes out. And a lot of times what actually is happening is people are really inserting their own personal dramas into this other drama, which they've turned into their own stories. And in a way, the film is about the nature of storytelling. The last three of my films have been about sort of staging these fantasies that are inside of us. And this was a way to do that. This was a way to get at sort of the way we fantasize about history and the way we mythologize stories from our past. And when you open those up, and the way we did it was through these interventions, when you open that up, when you shake that snow globe, other things emerge.
One of the things I thought was interesting about the film was it seemed to be like very aware of itself. There were a few moments where you could see the camera people or someone holding a boom mic, and it did kind of remind me that, like, oh, this is an intervention and a way for people to process these like deep-seated feelings. Can you talk about creating an environment where people do process those feelings?
To me, the deportation is sort of this founding myth of Bisbee in a way. It really does embody the tensions of the place, and subsequently embodies some of the tensions of this country, some of which we understand very intimately because of the immigration issues. It also embodies tensions between labor and capital. I mean, these are old, like, sort of debates that we, in 2017, 2018, we feel like we've gotten past some of these debates, and we haven't. The deportation, just in a way, is one of the most crystalline, sort of focused versions of that, you know, basic tension, which is at the heart of capitalism. We started filming in October of 2016, so a month before the election, with no idea that Trump would be president. No one thought that at the time. And so the labor tensions were much more interesting, really, in some ways, and how those overlapped with immigration issues, which were going on way before Trump, and they're going to keep going on way after he's gone. Of course, I guess the focus of the film was forced upon us in a way once Trump was elected. But it was always going to be about what the people in 2017 were dealing with, whatever that was. So the tensions are 2017 tensions. The movie never takes place in the past. It's always in the present. And that's, you know, that was the idea going in. So we knew that we were sort of acting as conjurers, in a sense. We were coming into town, and it's always about the people within that place. So watching people process these roles that they're playing was always the central idea, and is what you see as the drama playing out on screen.
That was KBIA's Abby Ivory Gagne speaking with director Robert Green of Bisbee 17. La Flor de la Vida follows 83-year-old Aldo and his wife Gabriela as they move on from their divorce after 50 years together. Directors Adriana Loaf and Claudia Abend wanted to explore the fears we associate with aging, while at the same time redefining old age as a time of new beginnings. KBIA's Haley Broughton spoke with Loaf and Abend on how the film came to be.
We placed an advert in the newspaper that said, if you're over 80 years old and you want to share your story with us, give us a call. One day, a man who sat down and said, proclaimed, I'm the perfect protagonist for this film. And he told us that he had recently separated from his wife. And we realized that the story of this couple that had been together for 5 decades and had undergone a crisis and were going through very important decisions in their lives was like the story that we wanted to tell.
What was it like working with Aldo and Gabriela?
It was very different with each one of them. Aldo loved the camera, and Aldo also loved the company. He really appreciated having us around, and he would say it, you know, openly, Like, the reason why I'm doing this is a little bit because of the film and a lot because I like having you guys around. While Gabriela is much more, you know, low-key, she didn't enjoy that much being filmed, but she was a good sport and allowed us to be there. But it clearly showed how their personalities were so different.
Were there any moments while filming that stuck out to you both?
One thing that stood out was that after we ended up shooting with Aldo, Aldo always wanted to keep us around. Aldo was telling us about a frustration he had had, and he was really down, you know. I wouldn't say depressed, but he was terribly sad and disappointed. And we were talking and shooting, the camera was on, and he reached out and held our hands in appreciation for, you know, our presence, our dialogue with him. And this is a man who is, as I said, very intelligent, very confident, he projects this image of power, of independence, of, you know, like larger than life. And all of a sudden he became really vulnerable and really, he opened up about his loneliness, and that was really, really, powerful, because that's very universal and very human.
And why did you both decide to tell this story now?
I mean, I don't know. As filmmakers, we are always, like, looking around and looking for stories to tell, and also looking inside, like, looking for the things that worry us, the things that scare us. Like, who's not a little bit afraid of the passing of time, of aging, of growing old? Who doesn't wonder whether their relationship with a significant other will sustain, you know, the challenge of time? Who doesn't have, you know, parents or relatives or people that we love that are going through health issues and other challenges? So all these were, like, as I said, fears or questions we had bottled up inside, and telling the story was a way of trying to look into some sort of crystal ball, into a possible future, and realizing that, you know, we're in our 30s, we may still have time to, you know, make decisions.
I wonder why the title La Flor de la Vida.
Claudia?
Actually, we didn't like the title so much.
So basically, La Flor de la Vida is an expression that in Spanish refers to the prime of life. And it may seem like an irony that we chose to put this title. But at the same time, we felt that with the passing of time and with aging comes, I don't want to say wisdom because it sounds like a cliche, but, you know, a clearer way of looking at things, of being more honest, of being brave to make decisions.
I'm wondering what you both hope the audience takes away from the film after they view it.
That perhaps people leave the theater more with questions about their own lives rather than judgments on the lives of our characters. I think it's really powerful that people, after watching the film, instead of talking about what happened to this particular marriage, people begin to talk about their own relationships and their own marriages. So I think there really is some sort of mirror where each one projects their own personal stories in the lives of Aldo and Gabriela.
That was KBIA's Haley Broughton speaking with Adriana Loaf and Claudia Abend about their film La Flor de la Vida. This is Intersection on KBIA. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today, we're speaking with directors whose films are showing at the True False Film Fest, which starts on Thursday. Directors Eric Stoll and Chase Whiteside moved to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, planning to make a film about tourism. Instead, a chance meeting led them to the story At the Center of America. It's a film about caretaking, complicated family dynamics, and the bond between three brothers and their grandmother, whose name is America. KBIA's Elena Rivera spoke with directors Stoll and Whiteside about their first chance meeting with Diego, one of the film's protagonists.
I'd love to know how you first found out about the story in America.
So let's see. So what, almost four years ago, Chase and I moved temporarily down to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. It's like a big tourist town in the Pacific Ocean with kind of a concept about a film about tourism. And but while we were there, we met Diego just through some mutual friends, met him at a party. You know, our Spanish was terrible at the time, and he was possessed with very good English skills. So it was like easy to get to know and get along with, and had some similar interests in film and philosophy. Anyway, very interesting guy. And at the end of the night, just as we were saying goodbye, he suddenly asked if he could come live with Chase and I. he revealed that earlier that day he had lost his home. He'd been kicked out of his apartment. He didn't have anywhere to crash. And could he come crash with us? And
I was the more skeptical one, actually.
Yeah, Chase was against it. But we decided, like, okay, you could stay here one night. and we woke up and he was gone. He wasn't there, you know. So weren't sure if we'd see him again or what. But a couple days later, he showed up and he was kind of living with us part time. And we became fast friends, sort of parallel to the project, the other project Chase and I were working on. And we'd sort of filmed with him casually. He's like, you know, he's a really charismatic person.
Great on screen.
And so we filmed with him some, but weren't really sure where it was going. And then the situation with his grandma, America, unfolded, and he had to return to Colima, and we followed him from there and abandoned the other project.
When in the process did you think, okay, the movie we intended to make is actually going to be a totally different movie? What was that moment like of realization that, like, there was a different story that you actually came to tell?
I think it was the first time we saw footage of America, just seeing how much she kind of popped off the screen and how her relationship with Diego just seemed so unlike, I think, our own relationships with our older relatives. And just seeing that, I think, was more compelling than the footage we were getting for the other project.
That's very true. The slightly more cynical side might be that we'd already invested, you know, 6 months and all this time and effort into making some film, and which, you know, we weren't really sure where it was going. And so when we thought we saw a story in Diego, eager to salvage any film out of the time we had put into our time in Mexico, our time working on this project, it was easy for me to jump at it and say, okay, no, this is the film, let's go.
What are you hoping that people who watch the film take away from it? What are the lessons you're hoping they learn, or the people they fall in love with when watching?
Like, definitely for me is to just get people, you know, thinking about certainly like care and the kind of responsibilities people take on when they are responsible for caring for someone, whether it's, you know, a parent, a grandparent, someone with a disability, child, whatever, and complicate people's idea of care and how it's so grounded in individual morality. How we talk about care, like, oh, they're a good parent, they're a bad parent, mm-hmm. they're this person, they're that, and to just think a little bit bigger about like how our ability to like care for and love those around us is influenced by our like social and economic, political like systems.
Caretaking is something that everyone, you know, has to deal with at some point in their lives, whether it's with their parents, someone else they love, or themselves eventually. And so I don't think it's a great leap for someone to watch this film and think about how their family has dealt with the very same issues. And, you know, like Eric said, it's such a personal morality decision. I think there are a lot of people who are going to watch this film and even maybe feel differently about how they might have handled a caretaking situation.
I mean, I showed a rough cut to my family a couple months ago, and you know, I wasn't really thinking about how the film would or wouldn't resonate with them. It was just kind of like we were together for Thanksgiving, and you know, people were sharing what they'd been up to, and I was kind of like, okay, you guys want to watch my movie? and we didn't really talk about it afterwards, so I can't be sure. But I, you know, my dad went through a really hard situation with his parents when they got sick. And it caused all kinds of conflict between he and his siblings. They spent their final months or maybe a year in like a out of their home in a nursing home, you know, being cared for by professionals. While watching it, I was realizing that it just occurred to me actually how like watching the film might have been stirring up a lot of regret or disconsiderations or feelings or stories tied to his experience doing that. And so that's something I'd like to talk with him more. And I kind of suspect that when we show the film that at least half the audience, you know, will have a story, a similar story.
That was KBIA's Elena Rivera speaking with directors Eric Stoll and Chase Whiteside of America. This is Intersection on KBIA, and today we're speaking with directors whose films are showing at the True False Film Festival this week. Crime and Punishment follows a group of NYPD officers facing retaliation after speaking out against alleged illegal policing quotas. KBIA's Aviva Okeson-Haberman spoke with director Stephen Meng about why his film is different from other police documentaries.
I think the hardest thing about this project was trying to make a film about something that the public probably largely feels they are very aware of and exposed to on a near daily or weekly basis, you know, through social media and news that comes out about policing on a regular basis. So for me, the challenge was how we could find a really unique cinematic form that would present things that people thought might be familiar, but in an entirely new way. And the biggest part of that was going deep with characters and creating a really immersive experience where we could be in the pocket with police officers as they are making real-time decisions that impact their careers, their personal lives, their safety even at times, and allow the film to be structured in a very kind of loose, almost David Simon way that would link seemingly unrelated stories into a larger systemic view of policing in New York City.
What did you learn from the officers that you didn't expect to learn from being, you know, this fly on the wall?
You know, I didn't expect them to be as outspoken and as bold in their assessment in calling out policies that traditionally many would have just reserved for more provocative ends of the police reform debate. So, I never thought that they would come out and actually do as much as they did and be as dedicated as they were. I wasn't surprised based on like the integrity of individuals that they all were, but a lot is on the line when you call out the most powerful policing institution in the United States and you are putting not just sort of the information of what's happening out there, but you're putting your own personal story out there. And so this was incredibly moving and inspiring and, even at times alarming. And that's why we spent as long as we did developing the relationships and then filming so that we could watch them take the actions that they were doing on their own and not necessarily be, putting them out and exposing them out prematurely or before they were ready to on their own.
Were you ever worried that them participating in your film would put them in a greater position of, you know, risking, you know, their job or their friendships?
Sure. I mean, in the early months, that was always a concern. And what I realized over the years as I continued to film with them was that there was this kind of sense of trust just for the mere fact that I was showing up and continuing to film week by week as the years wore on and as they kind of went through these high and low points.
So, you know, over the course of the time that you filmed this, the Black Lives Matter movement starts, and there's more media attention to this issue of community policing. And since you've been with this group for such a long time, I was wondering, what do you think the media missed about this narrative?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I don't think the media necessarily missed a whole lot. Don't take me on face value with that. But because there are many smaller stories or other stories that the media constantly misses. But in terms of sort of the big picture bulk items, I don't think the media necessarily misses everything. But I do think that what the press often misses is the importance of connecting the dots and trying to represent kind of systemic dysfunction. And I know that's a very big... It's a very tall order, but I think that it's very hard to make progress in, say, the area of police reform, right? The department itself will say that they absolutely have an investment in reforming their policies so that they are more effective and that the community trusts them more, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's actually so much bigger than... any singular event that may unfold.
That was KBIA's Aviva Okeson-Haberman speaking with director Steve Meng about his film, Crime and Punishment. Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And thank you to directors Robert Green, Adriana Loeff, Claudia Abend, Eric Stoll, Chase Whiteside, Tim Wardle, and Steve Meng. All have films showing at the True False Film Fest, which starts this Thursday. Our music is Montana Skies. Did you know that you can subscribe to Intersection on iTunes and take us with you anywhere and listen at any time? To find us, search for Intersection KBIA and we'll pop up in iTunes. Our producers this week are Abby Ivory Gagna, Elena Rivera, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, Haley Broughton, and Hannah Rodriguez. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM.
Hey there, I'm Abby Ivory Gagna, a producer here on Intersection. I wanted to let you know that all this week you can hear conversations with directors whose films will be at True False this year. KBIA reporters talked to more than 10 directors to give you a taste of what you can expect at the fest. You can hear these conversations during Morning Edition and All Things Considered every day this week. Thanks for listening and see you next week.